Welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Phil McKenzie.
I'm Michael Brooks.
On Point is where we highlight someone getting it right. And we're joined in the studio with a man of 1,000 titles, 1,000 occupations. I'm really excited to have him join us. I'm Mr. Jason King, Professor Clive David Institute of Music.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Phil.
Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely glad to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
I think your 1,000 titles is a good place to start. Like you're literally a man who does a lot, and I don't think just professor kind of is enough to sum it up. So like for our listeners, kind of give them a paint the picture of some of the things that you're involved in.
Sure. I mean, I don't have 1,000 titles. I've got a couple official ones and then some some informal ones. My official title, I'm a professor at New York University in the Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music. So that's a training institute for the future generation of music industry leaders. So I'm a professor there. I'm director of writing history and emergent media studies. So that's music journalism and technology. I'm also director of global studies for the Clive Davis Institute. So I set up music programs in different places in the world. So we have a new program that just launched in Berlin, focused on future pop music studies, and also a program in Havana in Cuba. I've taught in different places in the world, Abu Dhabi, Singapore, as well as New York. And besides my NYU gig, I'm a journalist, so I write a lot for NPR, for Pitchfork, for Slate. I'm a talking head in a lot of music documentaries and various kinds of, you know, outlets where I'm talking about music, so on TV a lot. And I'm also a musician, so I'm a musician, DJ, producer, songwriter. I've got my own band called Company Freak, and I've worked for a lot of different artists and managed artists. So I do a lot of different things, and I think it's not, you know, there are other people who do that. There are people I admire who do that, someone like a Pharrell, somebody back in the past like a Harry Belafonte or Quincy Jones has done a lot of different things. I think the thing that's probably unusual about me is I just do them all at the same time. And I try not to be a jack of all trades. I just want to be like a master of everything that I'm doing. So I want to do things that I can comfortably feel like I have mastered.
Now, that road that you've been on to kind of get to this place where you can kind of live out this attempt to be a master at all of these different roles. I've been fortunate. I've known you for a little while, so I do know some of your backstory. Like, share a little bit of how you kind of got to New York and got involved in the music and art and creative scene here.
Sure. I was born and raised in Canada. Even when I was in Canada, I felt like I was a New Yorker.
Where in Canada?
In Edmonton, Alberta, Canada.
So you were really, you weren't even in like kind of proto hip Canada. I got it. Okay. No, I just got it.
Edmontonians
really,
would disagree with you.
But sorry?
Edmontonians will disagree with you.
But. Well, come at me, Edmontonians. Yeah. If you know how to like operate a vehicle.
They've got hockey sticks. They can.
Well, if they can make it here,
and
I'll see you. Oh, yeah. No, just curling and hockey sticks. That's great.
So, yeah. Born and raised Edmonton.
Much love that.
Spent a year in Ottawa doing journalism studies and then came to New York to focus on being an actor, singer, dancer. That's what I really wanted to do. I went to the American Musical and Dramatic Academy, which is a conservatory program that's mostly known these days, I think, for producing Janelle Monáe and Jason Derulo and artists like that. And performed for a while, but I got really interested in writing and being a kind of critical thinker around music and culture. And so I went to NYU, got my master's there, got my PhD. I was doing playwriting at the time. I had my plays produced regionally in regional theaters. And I got this really amazing opportunity to launch this program at NYU where, you know, we could create a music program that would be the equivalent of their famous film program and their famous theater program, even though Def Jam had started at Tisch School of the Arts back in the 80s. Rick Rubin started it out of his dorm room. Right. The Tisch School of the Arts at NYU was a legendary arts program, but never had a music program. So, you know, I was in a place where I got this amazing opportunity to work with the founder of the program, Clive Davis, and set up this program and develop the curriculum and so on. And kind of the rest is history.
Like when people think about setting up a music program, like walk us through some of that, because it's not just the technical or functional place for musicians to play and produce and create. There's a business component to this. There's an idea of teaching people or teaching artists about the the ins and outs of music as also a functioning business. And I think that's something people might not think of when they think about music programs. I don't know if others like a Berkeley is kind of known for that. So in that respect, I think what you guys have created is pretty unique. Like, what can you walk us through a little bit of that? Like, sure. Why that was important and how you created that?
Sure. I mean, if you're a musician, there's always been places where you can go and study music, a lot of conservatories and so on. There's also been music business programs of the past where you could learn how to be in the music business if you wanted to be a record label executive or be in management or to be part of music publishing. I think the thing that made us unique is when we launched this program in 2003 is that the music industry was going through a lot of changes at the time. Napster was about 4 years old. It had disrupted the music industry in a major way by introducing de-physicalized music, MP3s. So suddenly we're moving away from CDs into kind of like virtual music. And it completely economically destabilized the music industry. And so there were a lot of people wondering at that time what the future of the industry would look like. And I think it was fortuitous to be part of a music education program that could afford to be innovative and could afford to think about the future and could position itself as saying, instead of worrying about the future of music, why don't we create the future of music? So why don't we bring in students who are artists? So they come to the Tisch School of the Arts, they get a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree. They're studying all of the artistic aspects of music, songwriting, producing, that sort of thing, music theory. But they also have to study and master the business of music. So they have to learn how to write contracts and read contracts and to set up a business for themselves and to not only get incorporated but to figure out how to run it and to write a business plan and to, you know, empower themselves from a business perspective. So the program is really a mix of art and business in a way that other programs had not been before, I think. It's really holistic. So we have producers and performers and aspiring executives and journalists, music journalists, and all of them have to learn, everybody has to learn everything. So performers have to learn the business. Business people have to learn how to be in a studio and record music. Producers have to learn to perform. It's a real kind of holistic way of thinking about how music industry leaders should function. Very often at record labels, you have a lot of executives who are not close to music at all. They don't actually play music. They've never played an instrument. They may or may not even have an artistic sensibility, but they work with artists all day long. So what we wanted to do is to change the game a little bit and to produce this next generation of music industry leaders who would be artists who have entrepreneurial leadership skills.
Taking it back to you for a minute, because I think obviously in the way you've described your work and your portfolio and all the things you put together, you're obviously the perfect person to sort of get something like that off of the ground. And from the perspective of somebody who's listening to this, you know, we have a range of people listening to this show, but one of the sort of core missions is to be, you know, sort of a resource for creatives and kind of helping people follow their instincts and, you know, whatever capacity that is and sort of building things out, whether it's a project, work, or just really even themselves, their own careers. When you talk about what allowed you to bring and continue to bring so many things together, I guess I'm curious, like, what are the elements of that? Because it goes without saying that obviously you need talent and ability and range and a broad set of skill sets, right? That's on you and that's what you have. But then you also need to definitely know how to like assemble community and get resources and, you know, connect your threads with other threads. And that seems to me like in a broader sense, and maybe you can connect this as well, everything that you're doing at the Institute and this new, very shifted space we're in terms of music production and every other type of production and creative pursuit, the only answer to not basically just, you know, creating a system where, you know, there's a lot of people living in like digital serfdom and, you know, and the resources aren't really flowing is probably through kind of generating these opportunities and communities and also being able, like you, to work in a lot of different spaces. So I'm just kind of curious, like, you know, you gave us the outline and it's really impressive, but what does that actually look like? How did you create a path where you could bring together so many different things?
It's a great question. For me, I'm super pragmatic.
Right.
So as much as I'm creative and artistic and, you know, I've got my head in the clouds and I'm idealistic, I'm also incredibly pragmatic. So I'm always concerned about how do you actually create something, achieve something in a really pragmatic way. Yeah. And, you know, that comes down to trying to build consensus, for instance, when you're working on a project and getting a team to be able to execute something really well. I'm really interested in this idea of execution. How do you not only conceptualize an idea, but then how do you execute it well? I'm always teaching students how to do that, and I think I practice that myself, so I'm kind of working backwards. I know where I want to get to, and then I have to kind of work back to figure out exactly how to get there. With the Clive Davis Institute, you know, it was a situation where...
At the end of this interview, you're going to produce Matt's first record. We're working this backwards.
I would be totally happy to.
All right, yeah.
If we can make that work.
He's the new Snow.
Really?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
I don't think your listeners will know who Snow is. There's going to be some Googling going on.
Yeah. That's, you know what? Those who appreciate Google and the few who know love the reference.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's the way a Snow joke gets it.
Yeah, and there are a few who know Snow. And I think that might be a good thing.
You know, honestly, literally 6 or 7 years old when I first saw that video. And even then, I think I was cognizant enough to know that it was bad. Yeah. Just like on first viewing, like, I don't think this is good.
Yeah.
Anyways, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, nobody has ever revised their perspective on
Snow. He'll be on next week. Yeah.
But yeah, working backwards, trying to figure out how to get to the place you want to get to with Clive Davis Institute. You know, I knew that we didn't have the luxury of bringing in a student, having them pay a lot of tuition, and then saying, hey, you know, by the time you graduate, all your skills will be obsolete. We had to give them skills that were going to last. So working backward from there, I thought, well, if students are going to be graduating 4 years from now, let's say this is in 2003 when the program started, they're going to graduate in 2007, 2008, and then maybe 2 or 3 years out, they're going to actually start businesses and really implement their entrepreneurial ideas. You're talking about 2010. So if we have a program starting in 2003, we have to know what's going to happen in 2010. Not that we have a crystal ball, but we have to be thinking and planning ahead. So I've always been really interested in that kind of pragmatic way of building things. And, you know, I'm somebody who's very resourceful, and I'm allergic to the word no. I'm going to try to make something happen no matter what, right. As long as it makes sense to do it. And I probably will push to make things happen past the point that other people would have long ago stopped.
Yes.
I want to keep that thread going because we talked about the future, and that's something we talk about with our work, future proofing. And how do you, well, before I do the how, like, what do you have an opinion on where you think the music industry is going? There's so many different, most of what I read is doom and gloom to a certain extent, you know, maybe there's a snapshot where it's like, oh, for the first time, you know, there seems to be turning a light at the end of the tunnel, those sort of things. But beyond that, like, what are your opinions on the livelihood and the capability of the music industry to stay viable?
Well, I think one of the things that we've seen over the last 15 or 20 years is the decimation of the middle class in music, which is actually consistent with what you see going
everywhere else,
right? So this shrinking of the middle class, the increased visibility and kind of proliferation of not even the 1% in music, but like the 0.001%, which is Adele, Beyonce, Justin Timberlake. I mean, a handful of people who are making a lot of money and who are enormously successful and maybe even deservedly successful given the gifts that they have. But it's shrinking. And major labels can still produce those kinds of superstars, but they can't take as many risks as they could in the past. And so they can only kind of invest their money in a few hopefuls who are going to make it on that level. Then you see this sort of decimation of the middle class. And then there's just so many other people who are involved in the making of music, but are just doing it in a kind of subsistence way, right? And so that's been enormously kind of disturbing, shocking, right. A major, major change in music that a lot of people have had to figure out how to survive or how to kind of, you know, surf through those changes. So many people are interested in music. There's also way more music released in an average year than there ever has been in history. And so that's really promising. And I mean, we're to some degree in a kind of golden age of music making because there's just so much of it that's out there.
Related to that, I mean, the paradox that there's more of it than ever, but there's an even kind of smaller and smaller and smaller kind of monoculture of like the names that we know and the people that get all the resources. We were actually talking about this at our communion event recently. This same topic came
just
up
yesterday.
Just yesterday, and I guess 8 days ago when people are listening to this, or 3 days, well, whatever. We're future-proofing this episode, but I think, you know, to what extent can we keep kind of being excited about the fact that there is more out there than ever if people aren't accessing it, right? Like, if there's more options, but we're still getting pushed in narrower and narrower ways, it almost starts to make, you know, in some ways paradoxically, like the old system actually had more range in a certain limited sense, but with, you know, resources to invest in a broader range of people to at least get a broader set of, you know, of ears on different kind of music.
It's tricky. I remember, you know, back in the day, you know, I've always loved R&B, and in the 1980s, early 1980s, let's say, you could know every single R&B album that was released in a year if you were an expert.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, there was like 300 maybe, right, that were released, and you could have a certain kind of mastery over that because you knew exactly what was released, and that was your domain. Today, there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of records being put out in an average year. So nobody, and you know, beyond just records, I mean, SoundCloud, you know, demos and all kinds of other stuff.
Right,
so who has any idea, you know, what is good or what is bad or what is the best record in an average year? We're just sort of guessing at this point because nobody can know everything that's out there. So from an artist perspective, it's difficult because although you have the tools now to make the kind of music you want to make because technology is a lot more democratic than it's ever been, it's cheaper, you can just go on GarageBand and make an album. You don't have to rent a recording studio in the way that you had to 30, 40 years ago. The problem is, how do you get heard above the traffic and the din and the noise? There's just so many people making work. How do you get people's attention? The game has really switched to getting people's attention at this point.
Right.
And so that has both its positives and its negatives. Yeah, I mean, on one hand, you know, there was more, maybe more range in certain kinds of ways in the past. There was certainly more expertise and certain kind of mastery on the side of performers and producers. But on the other hand, we're at a stage now where we have Spotify, and we've got Pandora, and we've got, you know, Tidal, and we have access to millions and millions of tracks at our fingertips in a way that we never had before, and that's a major powerful thing.
What are the positive and negative sides of that attention situation?
I mean, I think the positives are that it has created a different type of artist, which again, that you could also see that as a negative, but it's
no, but either way, yeah. Do you mean like in the sense that like now when a song comes out, like we were actually talking about this also recently, like it's not just a song. It's like, well, how is this gonna fit with something that happens on Instagram with this song, or what kind of dance goes? I guess the dance going along with something is older, but you know, like a broader set of things that you consider when you put something out. Is that kind of partially what you're talking about? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I mean, I think, you know, something like Beyonce's Lemonade is a very specifically 21st century product, although it has its roots in things like Michael Jackson's Thriller and, you know, the kind of connection between music and video that's existed for at least 35, 40 years in that form. But, you know, it's something very specific to now. The way that it registers is very specific to now. It's trying to be immersive and kind of, you know, appeal to multi-senses at the same time. So I think that's one thing. I think it is definitely a positive that more people have access and more people can release music, and you can test things out and try things out. And, you know, Kanye releases Life of Pablo and then he wants to revise it. And so we're seeing new forms of artistry that we haven't seen in the past, where an artist could like actually revise an album. Can you imagine the Beatles revised Sgt. Pepper's on a regular basis and just kept re-releasing it in the same year that it came out?
I would imagine even more conflict between Paul and John.
Although I hear there's a new version of it coming out with the tracks that were left off. So it's like the new Coke situation, right?
I'm worried about that. I always get angry. Like every time, like someone's like, "There's the new undiscovered Bob Marley record." I'm like, I don't really want to hear that.
Yeah,
I love Bob Marley. I don't
sometimes
necessarily need
were left
that.
Undiscovered
yeah,
for
right, exactly. Like not. Reason. Yeah, exactly. They are not. They're not all hidden gems.
Yeah, I'm kind of worried about those Prince vaults. Like, there's probably some amazing stuff in there, but there might be some not so amazing stuff.
Well, what you worry about is the artist not having the control to figure out what he or she wants to release, and it's at the hands of the estate. The estate could be a great estate that is actually really creative and really thoughtful and mindful of the artist's intentions, or it could be in a state that's just trying to make a whole bunch of money and doesn't really care. I think some, you know, when we've seen some of these releases come out from artists who've passed away, sometimes some of the stuff has been absolutely amazing. There's been really,
like, I think the Jimi Hendrix stuff. Estate has been good,
very good
on that.
Yeah,
you know, like I years ago when I first started getting into Jimi Hendrix, I got like a Jimi Hendrix blues record, and it was a lot of music he did just covering old blues artists, and it really opened up like what his, like the roots of his music as a young person just getting into it. It took it more beyond the psychedelic where I came in into establishing like, oh, there's deep blues roots to a lot of the stuff that he does that when you're like 16, 17 years old, you just, fuck do you know? You just don't know that.
Yeah.
You know?
And I want to know, you know, I love hearing alternate takes and alternate take number one, alternate take number two, and to see the difference between that and the original and all of that stuff is really interesting. You know, and the fact that we live in an age where we have a Spotify and we have millions of, tens of millions of tracks that we can listen to at any given time means that there's all this space for, you know, for these kinds of tracks to live, right? So in the past, a label could only release one Curtis Mayfield album a year, and now you can put out a whole bunch of stuff because there's way more, you know, opportunity to do so.
Before we got on mic, we were kind of talking about truths, you know, and establishing, I guess, opinions and expertise. I always feel like those things sort of blend together, that, you know, how do we judge art that's being created? And in this case, obviously, we're talking about music. Like, where do you fall down on that, that idea of coming into like a absolute truth or being somewhere to decide what's good, what's bad, what's working, what's not? Like, it seems like we've lost the ability to critique when it doesn't come from a place of like, oh, you're just hating on it, or you just don't like it, or, you know, we can't seem to give honest critique anymore without it being personalized.
I mean, I give it all the time.
Okay.
That's why I'm a pariah.
Wait, give us one.
So far, so good. No.
No, not of us. I'm not concerned about that. I mean, one of those, you know, what's one you got in trouble for recently?
Recently? I feel like I'm always getting in trouble for stuff. You know, I wrote...
Make more.
A few years ago, I wrote a piece on Drake for NPR.
Yes, I'm liking the sound of this. Okay, go ahead.
Which, you know, it was an interesting piece because NPR gave me the freedom to write it, and I wanted to write it, but...
Right. Turns out Drake's grandfather is on the NPR board. Is that what happened?
I don't know. I hope not.
Okay, yeah.
But my whole thing is I'm just going to write what I feel and what I think, you know, as long as it's informed and based in some research and thought.
And you felt and feeled about Drake?
Well, he had done an event at NYU, actually, and one of the first questions that the interviewer asked him was, you know, who's your kind of main inspiration? And he said, Sade.
Mm.
And I thought, wow, it's really interesting for an artist, a male artist in hip hop, who's at the top of his game, to find his primary inspiration to be Sade, a kind of sensual R&B singer. Right.
That's Matt's prime influence as well, so I don't, it's not that unusual.
Can't wait to hear Matt's music later.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting for you. Yeah.
So that was, you know, starting point A. And then he went on to say how Aaliyah was also another one of his major influences, and he's got tattoos of Aaliyah on his back and so on. And I thought, wow, this...
He would.
You know, male hip-hop artist who's... two chief inspirations are women and specific type of women who come from a specific moment, and it explains a lot about Drake, but I've never seen anybody write that about Drake or really go in depth into some of his fixations and obsessions and neuroses. And so what I want to do is just write this long piece that really went into thinking more about him. And, you know, some of his fans thought it was either offensive or whatever, but to me it was like, I want to be able to understand this guy and what he's done at this cultural moment and why he's actually one of the top MCs in hip hop.
Right.
And, you know, he's not Rakim. He's not Chuck D. He's not, you know, Biggie. He's a very different figure, and he's very much of his time and of his moment.
Right.
But what does that mean? So I wanted to just delve in deeper. And
that offended some people.
It probably did based on some of the comments and so on. But, you know, I'm like, I stand by it, and I think it's still a good piece of writing.
Yeah, that seems like a...
Yeah, that
like,
seems I don't quite see what would be I was about that. Like, I was looking for the, like, well, you call Drake whack column, which I would hug you. So I was looking
there's
for
there's some
that.
Of that in there.
Yeah. Oh, okay, good.
We differ on Drake in that. The studio.
I don't want to go in there. But, you know, no, I think we're also at a time in which there's this kind of regression of listening. I think there's also... You know, this kind of dumbing down that's happened in the culture over the last 30 or 40 years, but especially in the age of like reality TV and so on, where, you know, everybody's moved to the sort of imaginary middle, and it's hard to make certain kinds of critique because if you do, you're seen as an elitist person.
Do you think that also is a problem that relates to the attention economy though idea too? Because if you're in a situation where, you know, the positive benign side is we all need to build community with each other, we all need to support each other because, you know, the funding mechanisms and all the rest are different and people really need to band together, and that's a good thing. But on the other hand, things are so tenuous, and there's and again, this is in all different worlds. Like, and you're in certain networks, you might hesitate to put out that column or that tweet to be like, that doesn't sound good, or that's bullshit, because your next project might be contingent on the person that you're expressing an honest opinion of. You know what I mean? So I'm just wondering, in that kind of like social media driven space, like that might also lead to what you're talking about too, people kind of collapsing into that middle and not being able to have critique, but for very practical reasons, because the person you're critiquing might be a decision maker on a project a year down the road.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly possible. Yeah. I think also if you're expressing these critiques, you know, we're at a time in which, you know, there can be literally this kind of like surge of people who will basically kind of crush you and right. not allow you to speak anymore, kind of no platform you, and right. Because they don't like your opinion. And we've seen this even in benign areas, right? So like the rise of the quote unquote beehive, like the Beyonce fans who are super, super aggressive, and you cannot say anything negative about her in any way because it's almost like sacrilegious, right?
Right,
that to me, you know, although I appreciate, you know, fans who are really, really zealous about Beyonce because she's fantastic and deserving of people's attention. But that kind of standum is a form of anti-intellectualism to some degree, right? It's right. also about saying, like, I refuse to hear critique, right. even of someone who might be deserving of critique, because I have decided to idolize a person or to treat them as if they have no flaws. And I think we've seen this all the way up in culture, all the way up to even, you know, current presidential administration, that for some people it's very hard.
Wait, hold up. You're not criticizing the president, are you? Because you can get the fuck out of our studio. And that's not my opinion. Phil's very serious. Phil is the head of West Indians for Trump. So I don't really like Trump.
No one listening to this will, with the amount of vitriol and disgust that I routinely lay out, no one will ever believe that.
You're going to get some letters.
They don't even believe the jokes about Matt supporting Trump anymore.
Yeah, no one can. I want to keep going a little bit on that piece around critique and greatness and public figure. And again, this is something we talked about a little bit, so I prefaced it. But, you know, you talked about you being featured in documentaries. Most recently, you took part in the Michael Jackson documentary about Off the Wall. And in that documentary, they read a letter that Michael Jackson wrote to himself describing how much he wanted to change the face of everything. You know, so it goes beyond just music and every record that had been established, everything. And I'm not exaggerating this. Like, for those who haven't seen the film, definitely see the film. It's amazing. But he goes on about, I want to change what everyone has ever known about a modern artist. And rightfully so, we Michael Jackson's on a well-deserved pedestal. And then I think if you look at artists today, if they were to say the same thing or express those sorts of desires, I think most people would sort of pan them for that. You know, Kanye has come out and said a lot of outrageous things, like him or hate him. But to me, I lump all, like, usually I'll tell people, they're just artists, man. Like, that's what they do. Like, what do you think about that contextually with where we are in our sort of critique time?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that letter that Michael Jackson wrote in, and that is, you know, that we get to read in the Michael Jackson documentary that Spike Lee put together, that was a private letter. That was a letter that was in his, that's from his estate, that was in his home or wherever else, that no one really read until he passed away, and then it was demonstrated to us in the documentary. So that's an important distinction, right? Mm-hmm. Because those were his private thoughts, and those were thoughts that he wrote down to inspire himself to create the kind of art that he wanted to create and to be the kind of culture maker that he wanted to become. I think the difference in today's economy is that you have artists who are self-aggrandizing and doing it in a public space or a semi-public space, so on Twitter or whatever, in which case it's very much self-promotional. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the issue, that's part of the problem. However, let me just say, to be an artist requires, especially just to be an artist at this time in history, requires so much self-confidence, so much self-esteem, so much, you have to put yourself in a kind of bubble of some sorts in order to just sort of protect yourself from all of these kinds of threats and obstacles and challenges that limit and circumscribe your ability just to make art. That I think the kind of confidence and self-aggrandizing that we see from someone like Kanye is what he needs to be able to make the art that he does, mm-hmm. at this time. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I think in the scheme of everything that's going on in the world, and there's a lot that's going on in the world, someone like Kanye's, you know, boasting is really one of the least of our problems, right? But yet at the same time, I do think an issue is when there's that kind of self-aggrandizing and there isn't actually the talent to back it up, that's a problem. Michael Jackson actually had the talent to back it up. The reason that he actually was this culture maker, transformer, changer is because he had a particular set of skills that he had had since he was a kid that had been cultivated, honed, shaped. He was mentored by some of the greatest people in the music business, whether you're talking about Berry Gordy, watching Jackie Wilson perform literally from the wings, James Brown, on and on and on, Diana Ross, Gladys Knight. And he became who he was because he had soaked up all of this influence, and he had time to fail, time to make mistakes, time to go on the road, time to figure out who he was and what he needed to be and what he wanted to be. By the time you're looking at Off the Wall, he'd already had like an 11-year career. So, you know, he was a badass because he had been trained to be a badass. And when he bragged about it, he could afford to because he's that good. Today, a lot of folks are just sort of like popping out of the womb and just like, hey, I'm great. And
but
that's not really that good.
The medium though, right? Like, you're supposed to say you're great. Everybody can kind of get on that.
Well, I think it would be great
everybody's
if more
been taught to do that. That's almost like a form in and of itself. I mean, I get what you're saying. It'd be great if people could actually back it up. But if you grew up and listened to any music, I would say from, like, if your formative musical experience was like late 90s onwards, I'm some version of I'm the best, I'm great, I'll take your girl. That's 90% of it.
But I mean, I think that, you know, the game has changed, as I said before. So I think it's really changed to, instead of making, it's not about making the best work, it's getting people's attention.
Right.
That's what you need to do to stay afloat. And it's also about getting impressions, right? That's right. A very specific kind of 21st century,
right. You know, totally.
Post-internet notion. And I think when you're trying to get impressions, yeah, I mean, just to be able to say, hey, I'm the best at whatever and nobody can beat me, and to brag and so on is a way of getting impressions and getting people's attention. That in and of itself, that could get you, you know, a certain amount of visibility that could then get a brand interested in you, right?
Right.
So that's something very specific that Michael Jackson didn't necessarily have to deal with in 1983 that people have to deal with now.
I want to go out on one quick thing. What are like a couple of things in the music space, a couple of artists or bands that you dig that we should be aware of? This educator, because we have a section called The Crates. So it's where we would usually like pick something that we like, a piece of film, music, video, it could be anything. So we're talking to a music expert. Like, what are like one or two artists that you dig that we should check out?
Or you hate and we should avoid. No, I'm just playing.
I mean, I like a lot of stuff that's going on right now in music. Obviously, I like my own work, so Company Freak.
I'll
plug it in a moment of braggadocio.
There you go.
And you guys perform pretty often. Like, you're at Joe's Pub
We're in New York a lot.
Yeah.
And we do select gigs in different places in the world on occasion, but we're in New York pretty frequently. But, you know, as a producer and songwriter, I'm often kind of just listening to my own work because I'm trying to make the best stuff that I can, and I'm trying to make the stuff that moves me. Outside of my own stuff, I'm really loving Laura Mavula these days, the British singer, songwriter, extraordinaire, who had her sophomore album called The Dreaming Room released this year, in 2016. And I think it's one of the best records of that year. I don't think it got the attention that it needed to. She was recently dropped from her label, but she is a true cultural force. I mean, she's offering stuff we just haven't really seen before on the songwriting tip, on the arrangement tip, and so on. She's very, very unique, kind of classically trained R&B, pop, chamber, pop, rock. She's just, you know, doing something that we haven't seen before. Outside of that, I love some of the work that my students are doing, and some of my students who more recently graduated. As a rapper, Topaz, you should check out. It's doing some great stuff. Okay. Maggie Rogers is a student, came through the Clive Davis Institute, had some viral success with a video in which she was at a masterclass that I put together where Pharrell listened to her music, heard it, loved it, and the bemused expression on his face got a lot of people's attention.
Yeah, like almost tears.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. And, you know, she got a lot of visibility out of that and signed a record deal, and she's got a new project out that's pretty spectacular. Great. So there's some good stuff that's happening even at the student level. Clive Davis Institute, some of our students are doing really, really great work.
Awesome. And Jason, brother, it's always good to see you.
Hope
you're always on the road.
Soon.
Thanks for coming in.
If the Drake fans don't get me, I'll be back.
Oh, I'll protect you from them. I don't care.
And that's On Point.